Welcome to the CSIS Kajit Asia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colm Quinn. We'll start, as we always do, with the region's news. The Japanese government announced that it restarted the number one reactor at the Sendai nuclear power plant in Kagoshima Prefecture earlier this week. The reactor is the first to be reactivated following a series of new safety procedures and regulations put in place in the wake of the Fukushima disaster. After a monitoring period, a government inspection and confirmation that the reactor can be shut down, this would be the first of Japan's 54 nuclear power reactors to resume commercial operation. In Beijing, the People's Bank of China allowed the Chinese currency, the yuan, to depreciate by nearly 2% against the US dollar, the result of a policy change which surprised international currency markets on Tuesday. Facing sluggish economic growth and a sliding stock market, the change is China's largest devaluation since the mid-1990s. North Korea's Vice Premier Cho Yong-gon was reportedly executed after objecting to Kim Jong-un's policy on forest management. According to Yonhap News Agency, nearly 70 officials have been executed in North Korea since Kim Jong-un came to power. And that's the news. In this episode, we focus on Thailand, where the US has had a troubled relationship of late. The Thai military has a close working relationship with the US Department of Defense, which has allowed the United States to expand its security footprint in the region through annual training and multilateral exercises called Cobra Gold. However, the Thai military once again intervened in Thailand's fractious domestic politics, initiating a coup in May 2014 and embedding military leadership into virtually all government positions. The installed junta has repeatedly pushed back the timing of elections it promised would return a popularly elected democratic government. Given its support for democracies around the world, the United States shut down aid to the military and cut off senior-level dialogue with Bangkok, yet went forward with a scaled-down edition of Cobra Gold in 2015. Desmond Walton, the former US military attaché to Thailand, and prior to that, director for Southeast Asia in the National Security Council, sat down with my colleague, Jeff Bean.
Hi, my name is Jeff Bean. I'm the editor of Kajit Asia and the producer of the CSIS Asia Policy Blogs podcast. My guest today is Des Walton, and we're going to talk today a little bit about the U.S.-Taiwan relationship. Des, thanks for taking the time to sit down with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. And look, I just want to point out at the top that I think CSIS does splendid work in Southeast Asia, and I encourage you to keep it up.
Your recent piece in Kajit Asia, and then more importantly in the Wall Street Journal, made the case that it's important for observers and policymakers not to overlook the value of the mil-mil relationship with Thailand. What do you think are the strategic benefits that the United States, Thailand, and perhaps the broader region have gained from an enhanced U.S.-Thai military engagement over the last couple of years up until May 2014?
Right. Thanks, Jeff. Well, look, I do agree that that is a very important point, one that I found myself making frequently to visiting senior officials who would transit through Bangkok as I was the senior defense official there for the last 3 years. But in no particular order, I would rattle off a few things in answer to that question. First of all, Thailand is a capable military partner. They particularly, I think, have the capability to burden share with the United States, if you will, in areas like humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. Most recently, in the Nepal earthquake, where Thailand did indeed pitch in quite significantly in that disaster relief effort. And then I know that some of us do have short memories, but look, it was only about 10 years ago when Thailand agreed to support us in Iraq and Afghanistan. Those were two very difficult decisions, but in keeping with, I think, a fairly steadfast alliance partnership. So you have the capable partner piece, which I think is very important. Secondly is the access piece. I mean, look at a map of Asia and realizing our extensive security interests in that region, and you would look northwards towards Japan and Korea and see that we do enjoy some fairly good access in those two countries. But then one has to slip all the way down through the entire coast of China, past Vietnam, and finally arriving at Thailand to get your next reliable access point to Asia. And then if one continues that journey to the west, I don't know where, certainly not Bangladesh, Burma, or India, or Pakistan, perhaps somewhere out there, there is another reliable access point. But, you know, the main point here is that for U.S. forces that desire operational flexibility, access is important, and Thailand offers it. Thirdly, I would point out that a real key to U.S. security strategy in the region is to encourage the growth and development of multilateral security cooperation. And there is no greater partner in that effort than Thailand. Thailand, indeed, is probably the marquee venue for multilateral security cooperation in the Asia-Pacific region. They do that out of some innate sense of hospitality. They do it because it garners them prestige. They do it for a variety of reasons, but they do not raise the obstacles that other countries do, namely status of forces agreement and other legal agreements that must be in place before other countries are willing to host such things. Thailand does not require that, and therefore they are the leader in that region, and therefore very helpful to the United States to stimulate the growth of multilateral security cooperation. Finally, I would point out that, you know, this is kind of a real functional point to make, but, you know, the United States relies on overseas defense markets to support our industry, to promote interoperability. And Thailand has purchased over $2 billion worth of U.S. defense equipment over the last 5 years. So those are four, I think, very important points that answer the question as to the strategic importance of the U.S.-Thai relationship.
And what do you think would be lost if this engagement is cut off for an extended period?
Look, I think all of the things that I just noted are at risk to some degree, depending on the length of the estrangement, if you will. I think some of them will become more apparent more quickly. For example, access, I think, is the one factor most at risk in the near term. And indeed, we have seen some restrictions on access, notably during the recent Rohingya refugee crisis, where we made a formal request to Thailand to base some of our maritime patrol aircraft out of bases in Thailand, and that request was not granted. And there have been other examples as well. So look, I don't think the sky is falling on that point. However, we must note that we have seen the first restrictions on access begin to appear, and I think that's directly attributable to the estranged U.S.-Thai defense relationship. I think also, regarding my point about the market for U.S. defense products, I think that market is harmed, our ability to sell those products is harmed when there's an overall atmosphere of tension and estrangement. And indeed, we have seen signs of that, where U.S. products have essentially been in the running for various procurement programs and have not been selected by the Thais. And I think, you know, it's hard to kind of directly attribute these things, but my own view, years of experience, would make me conclude that the overall relationship is playing a role in those types of decisions. So those are the things that I think we'll see at risk in the near term. But in the long term, this is what I am most concerned about. I think that as the United States manages its portfolio of defense relationships in the Asia-Pacific with essentially one overarching strategic objective in mind, which is to protect U.S. interests, to support the overall rebalance effort, I think you would find that all of those relationships are underpinned by some level of high-level policy or strategic dialogue. And when you take that out of the equation, what you'll find is it's much harder to achieve alignment in strategic interests of the two countries. So I think our decision to essentially postpone or stop altogether that level of dialogue during this interim coup period is a strategic mistake. Look, I do understand that these types of dialogues and high-level delegations to-ing and fro-ing between capitals, you know, the optics of that get awkward. And indeed, there is some concern about if you're conferring legitimacy onto this government that is indeed a military government. And I can understand the concern there. However, I think that concern is outweighed by what one gains from these strategic dialogues, which is alignment on expectations regarding the alliance and overall long-term strategic priorities.
So you mentioned the difficult political situation right now in Thailand. This is the May of 2014 represents the second time in a less than 10-year period where the military has directly intervened in the domestic politics. We've also seen the installed junta government. Prayut and his colleagues have promised to return to democracy in late 2015, pushed it back essentially to September 2016, and potentially if the review of the latest constitutional reform is not approved, that roadmap is not approved, it may fall back even further to sometime in 2017. How, in your view, with this in mind, should U.S. policymakers, you know, try to square the circle with regard to the strategic importance that you've outlined that Thailand has to the United States and the difficult domestic, political, and human rights situation following the coup and the continued sort of postponement of a return to democracy?
Well, look, I am not by any means an apologist for the coup of May of 2014 or the subsequent curtailment of civil liberties and other things that have occurred. Look, I mean, the Thais would tell you that the coup prevented abuses because there was indeed a climate of violence and instability, and the coup kind of restored that sense of calm and reduced the violence. But then subsequently, there were notable curtailments of civil liberties and one could say human rights abuses. I personally did not see security forces committing violence against the Thai people, which I think would be a red line that no one would wish to cross. And if it had been crossed, would indeed result in a very severe step back from the relationship, if not ending it altogether. So, look, I am not satisfied with the political situation in Thailand at all. But if one looks back over the last 10 years, indeed even farther, the domestic politics of Thailand are the single most volatile issue that the United States could choose to kind of make the center point of the relationship. So what I mean by that is there are various pillars of every relationship: trade, economics, security cooperation, intelligence, law enforcement, people-to-people, cultural exchanges, and then there is indeed, you know, the matter of this country's domestic politics. And the United States takes note of domestic politics in almost all of our relationships. But to make that the centerpiece, particularly in regard to Thailand, where it has always been extremely volatile, to me just seems to be a miscalculation of where to place one's priorities. I think that a more pragmatic approach would yield greater benefit to the United States. And interestingly enough, I think it would put us in a more effective position to advocate for precisely those issues of civil liberties, the relationship between the civil and military sectors, the growth of democracy. I think, and I've argued in my writings, that I think that message is most effectively conveyed quietly without deliberate antagonism, made directly at a high level, in other words, prime minister level in Thailand. And I think that's the way for our concerns to be registered and for us to quietly follow through and sort of steer to the extent we can these very important issues. The converse of that is to kind of take a public stance and more or less be lecturing, haranguing, be essentially what's viewed by the Thais as very antagonistic, not offering necessarily the technical assistance that, you know, for example, in constitutional development, various aspects of law that are under consideration now, all could be approached, I think, in a very mutually productive way by offering assistance rather than just kind of standing back and saying that we don't like the process. So, look, those are my unsolicited views on how we should diplomatically deal with this coup. But the main point is that of all of the interests at play in Thailand, I think it's a mistake to choose politics as the center point. I think instead we should focus on those very tangible, very productive areas of our relationship, including trade and economics and all the ones that I mentioned, and then quietly deal with politics in a more productive, quiet, respectful way.
So, Des, you mentioned the emphasis that you would place on reopening bilateral dialogue with the very top leadership in Thailand for the United States and the importance of sustaining mil-mil engagement. What do you see as the benefits of that going forward?
Well, just as I kind of argued for the importance of strategic dialogue in general, because I think it's the only pathway for countries to achieve some sort of alignment on important issues, I think particularly in regard to Thailand at this moment, it's vitally important. So look, we have some history to look back on to judge the value or the effectiveness of policies that are kind of based on ostracizing governments or certain individuals therein. And so most recently, of course, in Myanmar, Burma, you know, there was a long, decades-long policy of essentially isolating Burma, which after careful review, the administration, I think, correctly decided was not a very productive or effective policy stance. So instead, we pivoted towards a policy of engagement. And I think that general approach recognized that within ASEAN, a cohesive body, 10 countries, they do not respond well to ostracizing one of their members. In fact, that very point prevented the United States from engaging ASEAN collectively for many, many years, simply because the United States would not sit down in a room with the leadership of Myanmar. And the ASEAN countries responded by saying, well, this meeting will not occur. So once we got over that point, we've embarked on a very effective engagement strategy with ASEAN. So bringing it down to the level of Thailand, again, I think that a pathway of dialogue, making our points on a variety of important issues, including those ones that so far have fallen upon deaf ears, if you want to say. In my article in the Wall Street Journal, I said that the Thais have tuned us out on issues related to democracy and civil rights and such things. I think that would not be the case if we made those points quietly and respectfully, directly to the highest echelons of the Thai government. I think we would gain some traction there, and we could indeed exert some influence. So, you know, in addition to all of those big points, you know, having done business in Southeast Asia for some time, there's this issue and some kind of, just say it's an issue of face, which to me conveys a sense of superficial, you know, you must, you know, not be insulting, or you must allow someone to kind of maintain their dignity, all kind of superficial things. What I would say is that by ostracizing the senior leadership in Thailand, there is indeed an element of loss of face. And what I'm concerned about is that the Thais will, instead of reacting to that kind of antiseptically and saying, oh, this is just a U.S. policy, position, you know, it'll evolve in our direction soon. Instead, they're going to react to this very emotionally, viscerally. And the decisions taken under those types of emotional frameworks, I think, are not likely to tend in the U.S. direction. I think when you see the rapprochement with China, perhaps that's not the best word because there always were decent relationships with China, but certainly a warming and a strengthening of ties with China. I think one can point to one factor kind of driving that is the lack of engagement on the U.S. side. There's simply no room for Thai senior leaders to visit Washington, or likewise no appetite on the U.S. side to send senior representatives, and I'm talking cabinet level, to Bangkok. And so in that vacuum, you know, you have seen the Thais increase their outreach, not just to China, but to other countries as well. The case for resuming high-level engagement is one that I think is starting to gain some traction here in Washington. There has been to date, no cabinet-level interaction except on the margins of some various multilateral meetings. But I think under consideration now is finding, you know, opportunities to resume that. So I leave that up to my colleagues that are currently in service.
Des, thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
On a personal note, here at the CSIS Asia team, we want to let folks in Tianjin, China, know that our thoughts and positive energy are headed your way following the horrifying explosions that occurred there yesterday evening. We're recording this on Thursday.
And that was Des Walton. And our one to watch this week comes from New Delhi. The Indian government announced it is suing food manufacturer Nestle for $100 million over unfair trade practices relating to its product, Maggi noodles. Maggi was banned in India after the National Food Safety Regulator accused Nestle of not complying with food safety laws related to the amount of lead in its noodles. Test centres at different locations in India cleared the most recent batch of noodles, but the Food Safety and Standards Authority of India overruled the tests. Nestle, which has 80% of India's instant noodles market, has challenged the ruling at the Bombay High Court. On Indian social media, one of the trending topics was whether every citizen who ate Maggi noodles would be distributed a portion of the funds if the consumer agency wins the class action lawsuit. And that's our show for this week. You can always find more at cogitasia.com and csis.org. Also check out our island tracker and maritime specific analysis on the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, or AMTI, microsite. I'm Colin Quinn. Thanks for listening.